It is Monday, August 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll hear from our correspondent in Bangkok, who was one of the first reporters on the scene of a deadly blast in the Thai capital. The Obama administration is reported to have warned China about sending Chinese agents to the United States to seek out corrupt Chinese expatriates. And we'll preview a new American film about the rise and fall of gangster rap pioneers N.W.A.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
It's all ahead on International Edition. The Thai capital Bangkok is coming to terms with a rare and deadly bombing outside one of its most popular tourist attractions. The death toll from Sunday night's attack near the Hindu Erawan Shrine stands at 18 people. More than 100 others were wounded by the blast, including foreign tourists. One of the first reporters on the scene was VOA's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief Steve Herman. I spoke with him a short time ago and asked him how he first heard about the blast.
Well, we literally heard the bomb go off in the VOA Bureau. We're on the 18th floor of an office building in central Bangkok, and I heard what sounded like a single long rumble of thunder. And I looked out the window. It was getting dark at that point and looked like there were some rain clouds out there. And the thought did go through my mind, this does sound a little bit like the bomb blasts that I experienced in Kabul, Afghanistan. But we don't have those sort of blasts in Bangkok. That's what I thought. Then we started to hear that it was very loud around the Grand Hyatt Erawan up the street, and people were being told to stay in the hotel until they figured what was going on. At that point, it became quickly obvious that something was amiss. There had been probably some sort of explosion. And we started to hear a lot of sirens. So Zinlat Ong, our videographer in the Bureau, and myself briskly walked over to the intersection of Sukhumvit and Ratchadamri, which any visitor to Bangkok will know, because this is where this famous little outdoor Hindu shrine, the Erawan Shrine, is located. And that was the place where the bomb had gone off.
Well, what was the scene like when you got there?
We were among the first reporters to get there, and so we were able to videotape from the gate, a little iron gate of the shrine, and it was evident that there were fatalities. We counted about six bodies under, I don't know if you call them sheets, but long white tarps or something that were in the shrine. The bodies had quickly been covered up. There were body parts out on the street in the intersection. And we could also see the direction of the blast because there was a bulge in the iron gate out towards Sukhumvit Road. And then straight beyond that bulge, there were several motorcycles down right there in the street. On Sukhumvit, there were no occupants, but two of those motorcycles were charred. And obviously anyone who had been on those bikes at that time could not have survived the blast. And we also saw some of the injured being removed on stretchers, and obviously a chaotic scene with more rescue vehicles, police arriving, and media. And eventually we were moved back, but for a long period of time, we were basically unhindered and had to be, frankly, very careful where we were walking because the area had not been secured for human remains. And then a passerby pointed to some weird object on the ground, and we saw that it was a small electronic circuit, a few centimeters across. And this was pointed out to the police, who quickly picked it up as evidence. And that's when we realized this was more than some, your typical small bomb, and we're being told by the authorities that there were apparently several kilograms of TNT or a similar substance that was placed in a pipe bomb in the shrine area.
Well, what was the general mood like in Bangkok tonight, given how unusual this level of violence is in that city?
Well, it was kind of strange because when we were heading up to the scene, and even though there were all these sirens going off, there was no scene of panic of people running in the streets. People were still walking on the sidewalk in both directions, seemingly oblivious to what was going on. But after that, Bangkok got very quiet. And we've now been informed that schools will not be open here today, Tuesday, although that the government offices will be open and banks are supposed to be open. And the military junta around, I guess it was 11 p.m. local time, about 4 hours after the blast, came on all the television channels to ask for calm. If anybody sees anything unusual, to call authorities, not to panic, for the media not to spread any rumors, and that the whoever is responsible for this will be hunted down. But they said it was too early to say who might have been behind this.
Okay, well, thank you to Steve Herman, our correspondent in Bangkok, for that report.
Sure, Michael.
Well, Steve Herman also was covering this story for us on social media. Earlier, I sat down with our social media producer, Andrew Palchevsky, and asked him what tools Herman was using to report from the site of the attack.
Well, Steve was one of the first people to break this story, and he did so on Twitter. Steve is a very prolific Twitter user, has over 38,000 Twitter followers, so he tweets out, people listen, and they certainly did on this story. He tweeted out at first that he thought it might have been thunder, or that there was smoke coming, and then more information as it came out as casualties and people that were injured. Steve also used a program called Periscope, which is partnered with Twitter. It's a video program where you can live stream things from your phone. And he was doing that, walking around the scene, interviewing people, asking questions. And Steve had thousands of people tuning into that. So that was how actually we got the first images from Steve, was via social media. So it shows how what a powerful tool that is. Sure enough, social media continues to follow the story. Bangkok is still a trending topic, as people continue to tweet about the victims, about who may have carried out the attack.
And what are they saying about the attacks on Twitter?
Well, the one thing I've been seeing is that it's described as the Times Square of Thailand, this area where this occurred. So people talking a lot about the geographic area, giving some context to that. And then just a lot of condolences, sadness for the loss, and again, wondering when justice is going to be come into play with who perpetrated the attack. And
I think I also saw the hashtag pray for Bangkok being used.
And that was actually one that I saw during Steve's Periscope. People were already using that initially. And this was, 20 or 30 minutes before other news organizations picked up this story. He was already covering it. So that's certainly one that I would expect to see in the coming days and maybe some other ones as we find out who did this.
All right. Well, Andrew Palchevsky, thank you for that social media update. If you want to follow Andrew on Twitter, you're at...
at APAL, APAL.
All right, great. So we will talk to you again soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Waste not, want not. That could be the motto of a shopping center in Brazil that's growing vegetables for its employees on its rooftop by using the waste from the mall at the garden. Besides providing food for employees, the initiative aims to reduce the mall's carbon footprint by reducing the amount of trash that would end up in a garbage dump. About 400 kilos of organic waste are generated every day from the mall's eateries, explains Cicero Evangelista, who is in charge of recycling.
We weigh the material and add enzymes that eliminate bacteria, reduce humidity, and accelerate decomposition. This is how we turn organic waste into organic compost.
In an effort to save as much waste as possible, workshops are held for mall employees so they can learn how to best collect garbage from their stores. Now that's something to feel good about, a project that reuses, reduces, and has social benefits. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. The price of oil is trading near six-year lows, and market watchers aren't predicting a rebound anytime soon. Alexis Christophorus, our business correspondent in New York, has been following that trend for us, and I asked her today what industry experts are saying about the reasons for the oil market slump.
Well, it was another tough day in the oil pits. Oil futures falling to $41.90 a barrel in the last session. Traders are continuing to focus on the global supply glut and production surplus. And in a weekly report, analysts at Morgan Stanley said they have concerns about crude fundamentals and prices in not only the second half of this year, but into next year. The bank is warning that oil demand is already near peak seasonal levels and will fall in the coming weeks as summer demand starts to wane. And the analysts believe there is still a lot of momentum behind this oil sell-off, and they remain bearish on oil prices for the time being. There's also concern surrounding the planned bankruptcy of U.S.-based Samson Resources. Analysts believe it may be the first of many oil and gas companies to declare bankruptcy, and that's a trend that could at some point hurt production. One move that may actually help support oil prices in the coming months is news that U.S. oil companies are expected to get approval to trade oil with Mexico, and this is seen as a milestone in loosening a four-decade ban on selling U.S. crude overseas, and it may prop up prices. Michael?
Thanks. Well, let's look at currencies now. The Chinese yuan was devalued last week, obviously. How is that affecting U.S. companies with exposure to China?
Well, executives at U.S. companies are already starting to warn about the China effect on earnings. We have more and more quarterly conference calls now, including executives detailing how a slowdown in China is hurting results. For example, the engine maker Cummins said demand for excavators in China fell 34% in the second quarter compared to a year ago, with no signs of improvement. The slowdown in China comes at a tough time for U.S. businesses. Overall, companies in the S&P 500 index are on track to eke out just a 1.2% increase in quarterly earnings. That would be the slowest growth we've seen in nearly 3 years. And China remains a relatively small part of operations at most big U.S. companies. Believe it or not, just 16 companies in the S&P 500 index say they collected 10% or more of their sales there, with most of those in the technology sector. But the promise of China's vast population and rapidly expanding middle class continue to lure big businesses there. Michael?
All right, not surprising. Well, I've been speaking to our business correspondent in New York, Alexis Christophorus. Thanks very much for that, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, well, let's stay with China news. And the New York Times says the Obama administration has sent warnings to China about Chinese law enforcement agents operating covertly in the United States. Those agents are suspected of trying to pressure prominent Chinese expatriates to return to China to face justice as part of Beijing's anti-corruption drive. VOA's Victor Beatty has the story.
The paper, citing anonymous American officials, says Beijing has dubbed the effort Operation Fox Hunt and is part of President Xi's wider anti-corruption battle, which is popular with the Chinese public. The Times says the agents involved are from the Ministry of Public Security and are not in the country on official government business and likely entered the U.S. on tourist or trade visas. The Times says since 2014, more than 930 suspects have been repatriated, including more than 70 who have returned voluntarily this year. It says they are part of an international operation to hunt down economic fugitives and persuade them to return home. The director of the operation is quoted as saying the agents are told to comply with local laws, but he says as long as there is information that there is a criminal suspect, we will chase them over there. We will take our work to them anywhere. RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harold says the operation involves going after what Chinese officials are calling tigers, or high-level officials accused of graft, and flies, referring to low-level officials.
The United States does not seek to be a place of refuge for anyone, foreign corrupt officials. However, the notion that China might send individuals to the United States to try to illegally pressure people who are here by threatening their families back at home or through use of coercion and physical intimidation or violence, of course, would violate all sorts of American laws.
The New York Times says while American officials did not disclose the identities or numbers of Chinese being sought, some are wanted for political crimes. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's tough for male elephant seals to find and attract a female mate during breeding season. It turns out that the competition for a lady elephant seal's attention is pretty stiff. While somewhat rare, very violent, bloody fights do break out between the opponents vying for the affection of a particular female. The male elephant seal mostly likes to make a lot of noise and stir up commotion by arguing and posturing among other rival males to attract a mate. But a new study by researchers at the University of California at Santa Cruz has found that the males also develop a natural form of voice recognition. They learn to recognize the unique call of their adversaries so that they can decide whether they should engage in a brutal fight or avoid confrontation by fleeing. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. As the United States and Cuba begin a new chapter in diplomatic relations, the business community on Wall Street is awaiting Congress's next move on the continuing U.S. trade embargo against Havana. Ross Kenneth Erkin is a personal finance editor for online American news site TheStreet.com. He tells VOA that U.S. investors are excited about the prospect of doing business with Cuba, but are also being realistic.
Overnight, Cubans aren't going to be drinking Starbucks lattes, eating Big Macs, staying in Marriotts. The country isn't going to change overnight. Cuba and Havana in particular are very... There's beauty in wreckage. It's dilapidated. The infrastructure is poor. Internet connectivity is low. And we're not going to see overnight mechanization, overnight modernization. And I think for that reason, people need to be a little bit more careful before they jump into investing.
Well, Erkin also says he has seen several examples of U.S. businesses being proactive about entering the Cuban market.
In terms of actually investing in individual American companies, Airbnb, Google, those executives have visited Cuba, Netflix. People are interested in figuring out a way to play up the modernization of Cuba. And Airbnb in particular has been the most successful thus far because of the Casa Particular, which is basically Cuba's bed and breakfast, rent out your apartment option. And it's popular across the island. Airbnb came in the spring and has over 2,000 possibilities the country over. So it's really tapped into a need for, there's a shortage of hotel rooms, a need for individual Cubans to make money, and that's allowing for a great transformation in the economy.
And that was Ross Kenneth Erkin, personal finance editor for TheStreet.com. Well, now for a look at the entertainment world. There is a new hit movie in the United States, a docudrama about the rise and fall of NWA, the music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap. The film Straight Outta Compton chronicles the discontent in Compton, a poor inner-city neighborhood of Los Angeles, wedged between gang violence and police abuse. And it also looks at how hip-hop music expressed the black community's anger and emotions. Here is a preview of the film from VOA's Penelope Palou.
Where you think you're going?
Man, I'm just trying to get home.
That's my son!
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
You ain't gotta talk to me.
In the tough black neighborhood of Compton, it often seemed like a teenager could not leave his house without getting into some kind of trouble with the police or gangsters.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton docudrama shows how that volatile state of affairs became the seedbed of rap music in the 1980s.
Cruising down the street in my 6-4.
And so NWA, the first rap group, was born.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
The group's tough lyrics on drugs, violence, and poverty, and its visceral music took the world by storm. Filmmaker Gary Gray says he worked hard to keep the story as authentic as possible, actually filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
People are scared of you, Dez. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
We put it all in the music, all our frustration and anger.
Ice Cube, now a Hollywood mogul, remembers what it was like.
Our music was like our weapon.
And that's the most powerful weapon we got.
His son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays his father as a young man.
They shed light on things that people needed to know.
Speak a little truth and people lose their minds.
But their lyrics prompted harsh public reaction outside of Compton.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
The film focuses on N.W.A.'s rise to fame and follows it through its rifts and final breakup.
Sit tight and let us do our job.
Hey, officer, I'm sorry. What is going
Sir?
On out?
Can you stay right there, please?
But its scenes of police violence are especially hard-hitting after the recent deaths of unarmed black men such as Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York City at the hands of police.
Well, you're wasting your time, Mr. Manager.
You gotta be kidding me.
You're wasting your time.
Really?
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like. Are you crazy? But that's police harassment.
Straight Outta Compton has attracted positive reviews for offering an authentic portrayal of N.W.A. and for taking us back to a time when daily violence bred a different kind of music. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Yo, Trey.
What up?
I got something to say.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. You can find us at voanews.com by clicking on the Programs tab at the top of the page, and then scrolling down and clicking on the link to the International Edition program page. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Zahra Abu Zaid. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'd love to hear from you on Twitter. I'm at Michael_Lippin, and the show's handle is at VOA_IE. Hope your week is off to a great start.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is gravely concerned about the plight of the Rohingya population in Southeast Asia. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority population of around 1.2 million people living in Burma's Rakhine State, where they are subject to religious-based discrimination and violence and exploitative conditions, including forced labor by the Burma Army, undue restrictions on freedom of movement, and impeded access to medical care and food. They are restricted in marriage and building or maintaining religious buildings. Despite living in Burma for generations, they are made stateless by policies set by previous military regimes. Tens of thousands live in camps for internally displaced persons, with little access to livelihoods, markets, food, or places of worship. They have become increasingly vulnerable to human traffickers, who entice them with promises of a better life abroad. Up to an estimated 500,000 undocumented Rohingya refugees live in neighboring Cox's Bazar district in Bangladesh, and around 32,000 registered Rohingya live in the district's Kutupalong and Nayapada refugee camps, having fled military campaigns and sustained persecution in Rakhine State. The United States has consistently called on the Burmese government to improve the humanitarian situation in Rakhine State by allowing unrestricted humanitarian access to all communities in need and facilitating the voluntary return of all internally displaced Rohingya to their places of origin. President Obama voiced his concerns earlier this summer.
I think if I were Rohingya, I would want to stay where I was born. I'd want to stay in the land where my parents had lived, but I'd want to make sure that my government was protecting me and that people were treating me fairly. That's what I'd want. And that's why it's so important, I think, as part of the democratic transition, to take very seriously this issue of how the Rohingya are treated.
We must all work together to address the conditions in Rakhine State.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.